Consider this startling paradox. If you look at the balance sheets of Microsoft and Alphabet right now, you will find that they spend a significantly higher percentage of their revenue on physical equipment than a heavy industrial gas manufacturer, or, you know, even a 160-year-old transcontinental railroad.
Yeah, I mean, it almost sounds like a misprint when you first hear it.
Right.
Because we've been conditioned for decades, really, to view these defining tech giants as the ultimate asset-light businesses. You know, these entities that just generate infinite cash from weightless code.
Exact.
So to suddenly see them outspending heavy industry on physical plant, well, it completely shatters that mental model.
It totally does. And that structural shift is exactly what we are unpacking today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm your host, and today we're looking at some fascinating research from the Infinite Investor and the broader Averaging Up collection.
Yes, and I'm really excited to get into this because we are trying to figure out a fundamental problem in business analysis here.
Which is basically, how do you know if a company's spending is actually compounding its future power, right? Or if it's just burning billions of dollars simply to prevent the business from falling apart.
Right. And to answer that for you, the listener, we really have to rethink what capital actually is, how it ages, and honestly, how it dies.
Yeah.
And a really good place to start that rethinking is by looking at a classic piece of financial observation from Warren Buffett back in 1983.
Oh, this is the famous See's Candies analysis.
It is. So Berkshire Hathaway bought See's Candies in 1972 for $25 million. But at the time of the purchase, See's had only about $8 million in net tangible assets.
So we were talking about things you can physically touch, right? Like inventory, the storefronts, the copper kettles.
Exactly, just the physical stuff. Yet on that $8 million base of physical stuff, See's was generating $2 million in after-tax earnings every single year.
Which, I mean, if you run the math on that, it's an astonishing 25% after-tax return on tangible equity.
Right. And a physical copper kettle doesn't inherently yield a 25% return just by boiling sugar.
No, definitely not. There has to be some sort of phantom engine driving that excess profitability.
And that phantom engine was a reputation that had been built over decades. The consumer loved the product so much that See's could just dictate the price based on the value to the buyer.
Rather than pricing based on the actual cost of production.
Yes. And Buffett called the capitalized value of this excess return economic goodwill.
But the crucial takeaway from that 1983 letter isn't really about calculating a precise dollar value for the See's Candies brand name, is it?
Not at all. I mean, he didn't build a massive discounted cash flow model to assign a specific weight to the reputation. He just read the value entirely off the return on tangible assets.
Right.
That exceptionally high return is a phenomenon we can call a trace signal. It doesn't measure the exact size of the intangible asset. It just proves the intangible is there operating in the background.
And it basically tells you it's worth your time to investigate. It makes me think of finding massive footprints in the mud while hiking. You know, you can't scoop up the footprint, put it on a scale, and determine that the bear weighs exactly 800 pounds.
Right.
But the sheer depth of the impression in the mud is a trace signal. It proves a massive animal is walking through the territory. You don't need the exact weight to know you're dealing with a grizzly.
That's a perfect way to look at it. A persistently high gross margin is a trace signal for pricing power. And a towering return on invested capital is a choice signal for extraordinary capital efficiency. The financial metric is just the footprint.
But here is where the tension comes in. For the last 30 years or so, academic accounting has looked at those massive footprints and just, well, pushed back on the entire premise.
They really have. This counterargument was heavily popularized by researchers like Brooke Lev. The objection is fundamentally about how standard accounting rules treat different types of spending.
Okay, unpack that for us.
Well, if the true productive asset of a modern business is a brand or a network effect or a massive body of software code, the money spent to build those things might never actually appear on the balance sheet as an asset.
Right, because accounting rules dictate that spending on research and development or like massive marketing campaigns has to be immediately expensed on the income statement.
Yes. It's treated the exact same way you treat buying paperclips or paying the monthly electric bill.
So think about the math of a return on invested capital calculation for a second. You divide the profit by the invested capital.
Exactly. Yep. And if the accounting rules force a company to expense billions of dollars in R&D rather than capitalizing it on the balance sheet, your denominator artificially shrinks.
The invested capital part.
Right. And if the denominator shrinks, the return percentage artificially inflates.
Which leads to this massive accusation from the academic side. I mean, they argue that the extraordinary returns of these modern capital-light businesses are largely a mathematical illusion.
Yeah, they're saying the capital isn't absent, it's just hidden in the expense column.
But if that accusation holds up, then the entire analytical framework of judging businesses by how efficiently they absorb capital is just broken. We would essentially be flying blind.
And that is exactly why the Averaging Up Collection ran a rigorous test on this specific premise. They wanted to see if the math was actually lying.
So they examined the financial architectures of six distinct companies, right?
Yes. They selected two light tolls, which were Visa and MSCI, then two heavy tolls, Lind, the industrial gas giant, and Union Pacific Railroad.
And finally, two transitioning pools, Alphabet and Microsoft. That is a wildly diverse group.
It really is.
I mean, putting Visa in the same comparative study as a 160-year-old railroad feels a bit counterintuitive, but I assume that's the whole point of the stress test.
It is the point. Let's actually isolate Visa for a second, because the findings there are incredibly revealing regarding this whole idea of hidden capital.
Okay, let's do it.
So Visa operates a global payment network that is virtually weightless in physical terms. If the academic theory is correct, Visa should have massive amounts of capital spending hidden in its income statement.
And at first glance, it really looks like they do. I mean, they pay out nearly $16 billion a year in what they call client incentive payments.
Right. Let's break down what that actually means in the real world. Client incentives are essentially bounties.
This is Visa paying a massive bank, like Chase, a specific amount of money to ensure Chase issues Visa cards to its customers instead of MasterCard.
Exactly. And it would be very easy for an analyst to point at that $16 billion and say, look, there is the hidden capital. They are building their network asset, but the accounting rules force them to expense it, which distorts their true returns.
But when you dig into Visa's actual accounting policies, the rules are highly precise, aren't they?
Very precise. When Visa makes an upfront fixed payment under a multi-year contract to secure a bank's business, they actually do capitalize that payment as an asset.
Wait, really? They do?
Yeah. They have over $7 billion sitting on their balance sheet right now, representing these capitalized multi-year contracts.
Oh, wow.
And that is actually larger than their entire physical property and technology base.
So the accounting rules are capturing the durable multi-year investments, which means that massive $16 billion chunk they expense on the income statement every year isn't a long-term investment disguised as an expense at all.
Nope. It is expensed because it is highly conditional, performance-based, and recurring.
This totally shifts the entire perspective. I mean, Visa is expensing that $16 billion because it is a constant, unavoidable burden. They pay it out based on the volume of transactions.
It's effectively a toll that Visa must pay to the banks just to keep its own toll bridge open.
Yeah, it's maintenance, not a permanent expansion of their empire.
Precisely. So the accounting distortion across these six companies turned out to be remarkably small. Economically durable spending is largely being captured on the balance sheets, even for the most asset-light companies.
The footprint is real. The returns are real. So the math is not lying to us.
Right.
But if the math isn't broken and the capital isn't hiding in the expense column, how do we explain the startling paradox we opened with?
That's the big question.
If we can trust the numbers, why are the most famous technology companies in the world suddenly spending like industrial manufacturers?
Because the problem isn't that we cannot see the capital. The problem is that investors misunderstand what the capital actually is.
Okay, explain that.
Let's look at the CapEx to revenue data from the collection for the fiscal years ending in 2025 and 2026. Lind builds massive, hyper-complex air separation plants. Their CapEx to revenue ratio sits at 15.5%.
And Union Pacific maintains thousands of miles of heavy rail network, and they are also at 15.5%.
Right. Heavy, physical, grinding industrial operations, spending about 15 cents of every dollar on equipment. Now look at the transitioning tech giants. Alphabet's CapEx to revenue is 22.7%.
Wow.
And Microsoft is at an astonishing 34.9%.
That's insane. Over a third of Microsoft's revenue is being poured into physical equipment.
Exactly. The narrative of the weightless, infinite margin software company has completely fractured. They're the most capital-intensive entities in this study.
But capital intensity itself isn't the core issue here, is it?
No, it's not. The defining thesis of this analysis, the mechanism you really must grasp to understand modern corporate power, is entirely dependent on the life of the asset bought. A dollar of capital expenditure is not a uniform concept.
It depends entirely on what the dollar is buying and how long that asset survives in the physical world.
Yes. Let's compare the assets. Union Pacific bought a rail corridor in 1862. They cleared the land, graded the earth, laid the foundation. That original corridor is still carrying freight today.
So the useful life of that foundational asset is practically infinite.
Right. And Lind builds an industrial gas plant, and that facility will run for 15 to 20 years under a fixed contract.
But when Microsoft and Alphabet spend a dollar of capital expenditure, they are buying servers.
And a server is essentially a highly specialized, incredibly expensive space heater. It runs incredibly hot, it processes intense workloads, and it goes obsolete terrifyingly fast.
Yeah, Microsoft depreciates those servers and network equipment over a timeline of just 2 to 6 years. Alphabet depreciates them over a maximum of 6 years.
Exactly. When these companies deploy capital, they're not buying a permanent asset. They are effectively renting computational capacity for half a decade.
And after that short window, the machine dies, becomes e-waste, and must be entirely replaced.
It's a completely different ballgame.
It really makes me think of the difference between pouring a concrete foundation and buying a massive block of ice in the middle of summer.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, both require an initial outlay of cash. Yeah. Both give you a physical base to work from. But the ice block is melting the very second you buy it. To maintain a 10-foot block of ice, you have to constantly spend money buying more ice just to replace what's turning into puddles.
Whereas the concrete you pour once.
Exactly.
The compounding danger of short-lived assets is severe. Because they decay so rapidly, the replacement obligation grows identically with the base.
So if you double the size of your server network, you are simultaneously doubling the amount of equipment you have to repurchase a few years from now just to maintain your current operational capacity.
Which brings us to a frankly staggering data point from the Averaging Up collection. Microsoft's property and equipment jumped from $205 billion to $313 billion in a single year.
$313 billion in physical plant.
Yeah. And because we know the useful life of those server assets is only 2 to 6 years, whatever fraction of that $313 billion represents data centers will have to be entirely repurchased before this decade ends.
So the aggressive growth capital expenditure of today is strictly dictating the mandatory maintenance capital expenditure of tomorrow.
Exactly. If you're an investor looking at these tech giants right now, this fundamentally alters how you should read their historical performance.
Because relying on historical return on capital for these entities has become highly dangerous.
Yes. Microsoft's reported historical metrics describe a legacy software business that distributed code on disks or basic downloads with almost no physical infrastructure requirement.
But that legacy machine is gone.
It is entirely gone. The investor today is purchasing equity in a completely new, capital-heavy physical machine.
The historical average might be mathematically accurate to the past, but it is deeply irrelevant to the future reality of their cash flow.
Which requires a practical shift in how we analyze these statements. We can't just look at top-line revenue growth or rely on historical efficiency anymore.
We need a diagnostic tool to see exactly how fast the ice is melting.
And the Infinite Investor provides a highly effective 10-second diagnostic for this exact problem. You simply open the cash flow statement, take the capital expenditure, and divide it by the depreciation.
CapEx divided by depreciation, what is that ratio actually telling us about the business?
It's not a final verdict, but it serves as a compass. It points you to the most critical questions in the footnotes. If you run the calculation and the ratio is near 1x, it means the company is spending roughly as much on new physical assets as its existing assets are losing in accounting value.
So the immediate question becomes, is the physical base standing still expensively? Like, are they deploying all this capital simply to tread water?
Exactly. They aren't building a bigger ice block. They are just buying enough ice to replace the melt.
Right.
But if you run the calculation and see a ratio near 3x, which is the territory Microsoft has been operating in, it signals that the physical base is expanding aggressively.
They are spending $3 for every $1 of depreciation.
Yes. So when you encounter a 3x ratio, you must immediately go to the useful life disclosures in the financial footnotes. You need to identify exactly how long those newly acquired assets will live.
Because you need to know exactly when that massive spending spree is going to boomerang back and hit the cash flow statement as a mandatory replacement cost.
You absolutely have to map the life cycle of the asset.
I do want to challenge this framework a bit, though.
Okay, let's hear it.
Let's say I'm analyzing a company. I run this 10-second diagnostic, and I find a low ratio, say, right around 1x. They're mostly just spending on replacement, but simultaneously, their earnings per share and operational efficiency are skyrocketing. How does this model account for a company that isn't expanding its physical base, but is getting wildly more profitable?
That is a critical nuance, and it's addressed directly in the Averaging Up collection through an anomaly identified in the 2025 data for Union Pacific.
Oh, perfect. It serves as a fascinating edge case to the rule, then.
Yes. Look at the mechanics of that. In 2025, Union Pacific reported completely flat volume. They did not move more total freight across their network.
Yeah, okay.
Furthermore, they only spent $3.8 billion on capital expenditure, and the vast majority of that, $2 billion, was explicitly classified as replacing existing infrastructure.
So only a tiny fraction, about $258 million, was allocated for capacity expansion.
Right. Flat volume, negligible expansion spending. By the logic we just established, this is a business standing perfectly still.
Yet their financial results told a completely different story. Earnings per share grew 8%.
And railcar velocity, which is the actual physical speed at which trains move across the network, that rose 8% too.
Mm-hmm.
Their workforce, locomotive, and fuel productivity hit best recorded levels.
How does that actually happen under the hood? I mean, if the physical track isn't expanding and they aren't taking on more freight volume, where is the operational leverage coming from?
The hypothesis presented is what we can call a multiplier anomaly. The core idea is that new capital expenditure doesn't always just add horizontally to the base. In certain environments, it acts as a multiplier on the return of the old capital.
Okay, walk me through a real-world scenario of that multiplier effect.
Sure. Imagine Union Pacific installs a highly advanced AI-driven planning software system, or they spend capital to reconfigure a physical bottleneck at a major switching terminal in Chicago.
So they are not laying hundreds of miles of new track.
No, they are not extending the physical footprint of the network at all.
But they are making the track that was laid in 1862 carry the existing freight at a much lower cost today.
Exactly. The new strategic capital reduces friction across the entire legacy system. It acts directly on the rate earned by the old capital.
That makes a lot of sense.
Now, the authors are disciplined in noting this is a hypothesis, not an immutable law. Rising earnings on flat volume could also be driven by mundane factors like aggressive cost cutting, share repurchases, or pure pricing power.
Sure, of course.
But the conceptual mechanism that a small deployment of new, high efficiency capital can multiply the value of a massive, fully depreciated asset base, it's an incredibly powerful analytical lens.
Going back to our analogy, it's the difference between buying more ice to make a larger block and spending your capital to buy a deep freezer to put your existing ice block inside.
Yes. One expands the physical base. The other radically alters the decay rate of the asset you already own.
The freezer literally changes the physical properties of the environment. So synthesizing all these threads, you know, Buffett's trace signals, the reality of capitalized incentives at Visa, the terrifying obsolescence cycle of tech hardware, and the multiplier effect on legacy railroads. What is the ultimate lesson for the listener here?
The defining takeaway from the Infinite Investor is that gross investment is a meaningless metric in isolation.
Right.
If a massive technology firm spends $100 billion today on infrastructure, but must spend $40 billion of it again within 6 years just to replace dead servers, they have not permanently added $100 billion of anything to the intrinsic value of the enterprise.
Because the only metric that dictates long-term survival is net productive capacity.
Exactly. Net productive capacity is what remains after the capital has lived, aged, and inevitably been replaced. If a business earns massive returns on very little tangible capital, the financial footprint is proving they possess a powerful and tangible asset.
But if a business requires massive ongoing deployments of tangible capital, you must judge it by a far more brutal standard. How often must that physical capital be rebuilt simply to stay in place?
We all want financial statements to be clean, binary documents. We want the label asset light to always guarantee high returns and low maintenance.
But the economic landscape is murky. The reality is that the companies we assumed were floating on weightless clouds of code are actually anchored to the earth by hundreds of billions of dollars of rapidly decaying silicon and steel.
So I want to challenge you, the listener, to examine the companies in your own purview, particularly the ones you have mentally categorized as immune to physical constraints. run that diagnostic ratio.
Are their massive investments truly compounding their permanent productive capacity, or are they quietly constructing a massive, unavoidable maintenance obligation that will mercilessly consume their cash flow tomorrow?
The ice block is always melting. Your job as an investor is to find out exactly how fast.
This content is educational and reflects a personal analytical framework. It does not constitute investment advice. Visit averagingup.com.